This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 4, Learn About Loss, by Cassandra Clare and Kelly Link. Read by Ross Butler.
On the morning of October 23rd, 1936, the inhabitants of Chattanooga, Tennessee woke up to discover posters tacked up on the sides of buildings on every street. "For a limited time only," the posters declared. "Magic and music and most mysterious merchants bazaar. Pay only what you can afford and enter fairyland. See what you most desire. All welcome." Some men and women passed these posters, shaking their heads. It was the height of the Great Depression. And even if the president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was promising more work on projects like the tunnel and trails and campgrounds underway in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, jobs were scarce and times were hard, and most people didn't have money to spare on fripperies or fun. And who wanted to travel all the way up Lookout Mountain only to be turned away because what you could afford was nothing? Besides, no one ever gave you something for nothing. But plenty of the other Chattanoogans saw the posters and thought, maybe better times really were just around the corner. There was a new deal, and maybe there would be new fun too. And there was not a single child who caught sight of the posters and didn't yearn with their entire heart for what the posters promised. The 6th of October was a Friday. On Saturday, at least half of the city of Chattanooga lit out for the carnival. Some of them packed bedrolls or tarps to sleep under. If there was music and festivity, maybe they would stay longer than a day. The churches of Chattanooga were poorly attended on Sunday morning, but the carnival in the Fairyland neighborhood of Lookout Mountain was busier than a beehive. Up on top of Lookout Mountain, a local boy named Garnet Carter had quite recently established the community of Fairyland, which included Tom Thumb Golf, the first miniature golf course in the United States. There was the eerie natural landscape of Rock City, where his wife, Frida Carter, had laid out paths between towering, mossy rock formations, planting wildflowers and importing German statuary, so that the trails were watched over by gnomes and characters from fairy tale stories like Little Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Pigs. Rich people came on holidays and rode the funicular, which also happened to be the world's steepest passenger railway, the mile up from Chattanooga to the Lookout Mountain Hotel. The hotel was also known as the Castle Above the Clouds, and if all the rooms were taken, well, there was also the Fairyland Inn. For the wealthy, there was golf and ballroom dancing and hunting. For the civic-minded, there was the site of the Battle Among the Clouds, where the Union Army had, in living memory, driven off at great cost the Confederates. You could still find Minié bullets and other traces of the dead all down the slopes of the mountain, along with flint arrowheads used by Cherokee. But the Cherokee had all been driven off, and the Civil War was over too. There had been a greater war in recent memory, and many a family in Chattanooga had lost sons or fathers to it. Human beings did terrible things to each other, and the traces of those terrible things were everywhere if you looked. If your tastes ran more to corn whiskey than history, well, there were plenty of moonshine stills up on Lookout Mountain, too. And who knew what other illegal and immoral delights could be found at a mysterious merchant's bazaar? There were men and women of money and taste at the carnival on that first Saturday, rubbing alongside the thin-faced children and wives of farmers. The rides were free to all. There were games with prizes, and a petting zoo with a three-headed dog, and a winged snake so large that it was able to swallow a full-grown steer each day at noon. There were strolling fiddle players who drew such melancholy and lovely songs out of their instruments that tears came to the eyes of all who heard them. There was a woman who said that she could speak with the dead, and ask no coin. There was a magician too, Roland the Astonishing, who grew a dogwood tree from a seed on his stage and then caused it to flower, drop its leaves, and grow bare again, as if all the seasons were passing in the blink of an eye. He was a handsome man in his 60s, with bright blue eyes, a luxuriant white mustache, and snowy white hair with a black streak running through it, as if some devil had touched it with a sooty hand. There were delicious things to eat at such a negligible cost, or freely given as samples, that every child ate himself or herself sick. As promised, the bazaar was full of remarkable objects on display, tended by even more remarkable people. Some of the customers, too, drew curious glances. Were there people in faraway lands who had curly tails or flames in their pupils? One of the most popular stalls had on offer a local product, a clear, potent liquor, rumored to give dreams of a moonlit forest full of running wolves to those who drank it. The men at that booth were taciturn and did not smile often, but when they did, their teeth were unsettlingly white. They lived up in the mountains and mostly kept to themselves, but here at the bazaar, they seemed quite at home. One tent was staffed by nurses so very lovely, it wasn't a chore at all to let them draw your blood. They took a cup or two, for research purposes, they said. And to those who donated, they gave away tokens that could be used elsewhere in the bazaar, just like money. Just beyond the tents of the bazaar was a sign that led to the maze of mirrors. It said, "See for yourself. The true world and the false lie next door to one another." Those who went through the maze of mirrors came out looking a little dazed. Some of them had found their way to the very center, in which they had been made an offer by an entity that each described differently. To some, the person in the room had appeared as a small child, or an old woman in an elegant gown, or even in the shape of a loved one long dead. The person in the room had a mask, and if you confessed the thing that you desired, the mask was put upon you and, well, you should really go and see for yourself. If, that is, you could find your way through the maze, into the place where that person in the mask were waiting. By the end of the first weekend, most of Chattanooga had come up to see for themselves the strange charms of the carnival, and many came back to the carnival on the second weekend, although by then, rumors were beginning to spread of troubling behavior exhibited by some who had returned. A woman claimed that the man she was married to was an imposter who had killed her real husband. This claim would have been easier to dismiss if a body had not been discovered in the river, in all ways a double of the man she was married to. A young man stood up in church and said that he saw and knew the secrets of all the congregation by looking at them. When he began to say these secrets out loud, the pastor tried to shout him down until the man began to declaim the things he knew about the pastor. At this, the pastor fell silent, then left his church and went home and slit his throat. Another man won again and again at a weekly game of poker until, drunk, he confessed, sounding astonished, that he could see the cards every man there held as if they were his very own hand. He proved this by calling out each card in order, and after that was beaten soundly and left unconscious and bloody in the street by men who had been his friends since childhood. A boy of 17, newly engaged to be married, came home from the carnival and that night woke up everyone in his household screaming. He had put out his own eyes with two hot coals, but refused to say why. In fact, he never spoke again, and his poor fiancée at last broke off the engagement and went to live with an aunt in Baltimore. A beautiful girl turned up at the Fairyland Inn at dusk one evening, claiming that she was Mrs. Dahlgray, when the staff of the inn knew very well Mrs. Dahlgray was a bucket-faced dowager in her late 70s. She stayed at the inn every fall and never tipped anyone, no matter how good the service. Other terrible incidents were reported in the neighborhoods of Chattanooga. And by the middle of the week after the carnival had put up its signs, word of these happenings had made its way to those whose business it was to prevent the human world from being troubled and tormented by the malicious whims of downworlders and demons. It is only to be expected that some amount of trouble will arrive with the carnival. Pleasure and trouble are brother and sister to each other, but there were indications that this particular carnival was more than it seemed. For one thing, the bazaar of the bazaar was not just trinkets and gaudy junk. The bazaar was a full-on shadow market where there had never been one before, and humans were strolling its aisles and freely handling its wares. And there were indications, too, that there was an artifact made out of adamas in the hands of one who should not have had it. For this reason, on Thursday the 29th of October, a portal opened at Lookout Point, and two individuals who had only just met stepped through it unnoticed by any of the human sightseers gathered there. One was a young woman not yet fully invested as an Iron Sister, although already her hands showed the scars and calluses of one who worked adamas. Her name was Amelia, and this was the last task her sisters had set her before she joined their company, to recover the adamas and bring it back to the Adamant Citadel. She had a smiling, watchful face, as if she liked the world but did not quite trust that it would be on its best behavior. Her companion was a silent brother who bore the runic marks on his face, although neither his eyes nor his mouth had been sewn shut. Instead, they were merely closed, as if he had voluntarily chosen to withdraw inside the citadel of his own self. He was handsome enough that if any of the women at Lookout Point had seen his face, one or two might have thought of fairy tales where a kiss is sufficient to wake one who's under an enchantment. Sister Amelia, who could see Brother Zachariah quite plainly, thought he was one of the handsomest men she had ever seen. Clearly, he was one of the first men she had seen in quite some time, and if their errands were successful and she returned to the Iron Citadel with the Adamus in her possession, well, it wouldn't be the worst thing if handsome Brother Zachariah was the last man she ever laid eyes on. There was no harm in appreciating beauty when you chanced upon it. She said, "Nice view, isn't it?" Because from the place they stood, you could see Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, both North and South Carolina, and, on the horizon, Virginia and Kentucky, too, all spread out, rumpled like a tapestry quilt, haphazardly embroidered in green and blue, little pricks of red and gold and orange where, in places, the trees were already beginning to turn. Inside her head, Brother Zachariah said, "It's extraordinary. Though, I confess, I had imagined America to look somewhat different. Someone I knew told me about New York City. That was where she grew up. We talked one day of going together to see the things and places that she loved. But we talked of many things that I knew, even then, would likely never happen. And this is a very large country." Sister Amelia was not at all sure that she liked having someone else talking inside her head. She had encountered silent brothers before, but this was the first time one had spoken directly into her mind. It was like having company show up when you hadn't had the inclination to do the dishes or straighten up your living quarters in a while. What if they could see all the untidy thoughts you sometimes just shoved under the carpet? Her mentor, Sister Laura, had assured Amelia that although silent brothers could ordinarily read the minds of those around them, their sisterhood was exempt. But on the other hand, what if this was part of the test she had been set? What if Brother Zachariah's task was also to look inside her brain to be sure that she was a deserving candidate? She thought, as loudly as she could, "Excuse me! Can you hear me thinking?" When Brother Zachariah didn't respond, she said, relieved, "Your first time in the States, then?" "Yes," Brother Zachariah said. Then, as if to be polite, he said, "And you?"
"Born and bred in California," Sister Amelia said. "I grew up in the San Francisco Conclave."
"Is San Francisco very like this?" Brother Zachariah said. She almost choked.
"Indeed," she said, "it is not. Not even the trees are the same, and the ground there is like as not to give you a little shake now and then. Sometimes just enough to move your bed a few inches while you're trying to sleep. Other times, it knocks buildings down without so much as a warning."
"Oh, but the fruits on the trees are the best thing you've ever tasted, and the sun shines every single day."
Her oldest brother had been an infant in their mother's arms during the earthquake of 1906. Half the city had burned, and Amelia's father said that even demons had stayed away during the destruction. Their mother, who had been pregnant, had had a miscarriage. If that baby had lived, Amelia would have had 7 siblings, all brothers. Her first night in the Iron Citadel, she had woken up every hour because it was all so quiet and peaceful.
"You sound as if you miss it," Brother Zachariah said.
Sister Amelia said, "I do miss it, but it was never home. Now, I believe the carnival's that a ways, and here we stand here jawing when we have work to do."
Although his eyes and ears and mouth had all been closed by the magic of the Silent City, Jem could still smell and hear the carnival much better than any mortal. Here was the scent of sugar and hot metal and, yes, blood as well, and the sounds of barkers and calliope music and excited shrieks. Soon enough, he could see it too. The carnival stood on mostly level ground where once there must have been quite a battle. Jem could feel the presence of the human dead. Now their forgotten remains lay buried under a grassy field where a kind of stockade fence had been erected around all manner of brightly colored tents and fanciful structures. A Ferris wheel stood above these, carriages dangling from the central wheel, full of laughing people. 2 great gates stood flung wide open, with a broad avenue between them, welcoming all who approached. Sweethearts in their Sunday clothes strolled through the gates, arms around each other's waists. 2 boys pelted past, one with tousled black hair. They looked about the age that Will and Jem had been, a very long time ago, when they'd first met. But Will's hair was white now, and Jem was no longer Jem. He was Brother Zachariah.
A few nights ago, he had sat at Will Herondale's bedside and watched his old friend struggle to draw breath. Jem's hand on the coverlet was the hand of a young man still, and Tessa, of course, would never grow old. How must it seem to Will, who loved them both, that he must go on so far ahead of them? But then, Jem had left Will first, and Will had had to let him go. It would only be fair when, soon, Jem would be the one left behind. Inside his head, Brother Enoch said, "It will be hard, but you will be able to bear it. We will help you bear it." "I will endure it because I must," Jem said. Sister Amelia had stopped and he had caught up with her. She was taking in the carnival, her hands on her hips.
"What a thing," she said. "Did you ever read Pinocchio?"
"I don't believe so," Jem told her, though he thought that once, when he'd been in the London Institute, he might have heard Tessa reading it to young James. "A wooden puppet yearns to be a real boy," Sister Amelia said. "And so a fairy gives him a wish, more or less, and he gets into all sorts of trouble at a place that I always thought would look rather like this," Jem said almost against his will.
"And does he?"
"Does he what?" Sister Amelia said.
"Does he become real?"
"Well, of course," Sister Amelia said. Then, saucily, "What kind of story would it be if he only got to be a puppet?" "His father loves him, and that's how he starts to become real, I guess. I always liked those stories the best. The ones where people could make things or carve things and make them come to life. Like Pygmalion." In his head, Brother Enoch said,
"She's quite lively, for an Iron Sister."
He didn't sound exactly disapproving, but neither was it a compliment. "Of course," Sister Amelia said. "You're something of a story yourself, Brother Zachariah."
"What do you know of me?" Jem said.
She said pertly, "That you fought Mortmain? That you once had a pair of tie and he became the head of the London Institute? That his wife, the warlock Tessa Gray, wears a pendant that you gave her? But I know something of you that perhaps you do not know yourself."
"That seems unlikely," Jem said. "But go on. Tell me what I do not know about myself."
"Give me your staff," Sister Amelia said. He gave it to her, and she examined it carefully. "Yes," she said. "I thought so. This was made by Sister Dial, whose weapons were so exquisitely wrought that it was rumored an angel had touched her forge. Look, her mark."
"It has served me well enough," Jem said. "Perhaps one day you too will find renown for the things that you make."
"One day," said Sister Amelia. She handed him back the staff. "Perhaps." There was a formidable glint in her eyes. Jem thought it made her look very young. The world was its own sort of crucible, and in it all dreams were tempered and tested. Many crumbled away entirely, and then he went on without them. In his head, his brothers murmured in agreement. After nearly 70 years, Jem was almost used to this. Instead of music, he had this stern brotherly chorus. Once upon a time, he had imagined each of the Silent Brothers as a musical instrument. Brother Enoch, he'd thought, would be a bassoon heard through the high-up window of a desolate lighthouse, the waves crashing down at the base. "Yes, yes," Brother Enoch had said. "Very poetic. And what are you, Brother Zachariah?" Jem had tried not to think of his violin, but you couldn't keep secrets from your brothers. And that violin had lain silent and neglected for a very long time. He said, attempting to think of other things as they walked,
"Can you tell me if you know anything of an Annabel Blackthorne, an Iron Sister? She and a friend of mine, the warlock Malcolm Fade, fell in love and made plans to run away together. But when her family discovered this, they forced her to join the Iron Sisterhood. It would ease his mind to know something of what her life has been in the Adamant Citadel."
Sister Amelia said, "It's clear that you know very little about the Iron Sisters. No one is ever forced to join against their will. Indeed, it is a great honor, and many who attempt the path are turned away. If this Annabel became an Iron Sister, she chose that for herself. I know nothing of her, although it's true that most of us change our names when we are consecrated." Jem said,
"If you come to know anything of her, my friend would be most grateful. He does not speak of her much, but I believe that she's always in his thoughts."
When Jem and Sister Amelia passed through the gates of the carnival, the first strange thing they saw was a werewolf eating cotton candy out of a paper cone.
Sticky pink strands were caught in his beard.
"Full moon tonight," Sister Amelia said. "The Praetor Lupus has sent down some of their people, but it said that the werewolves here are a lot themselves. They run moonshine and ride roughshod in the mountains. These boys should be steering clear of mundanes this time of the month, not eating cotton candy and peddling rot gut." The werewolf stuck out its tongue at them and sauntered away.
"Sauce," Sister Amelia said, and would have pursued the werewolf.
Jem said, "Hold. There are worse things here than downworlders with terrible manners and sweet tooths. Can you smell that?" Sister Amelia wrinkled her nose. "Demon," she said. They followed the smell through the winding alleys of the carnival, through the strangest iteration of the shadow market that Jem had ever seen. The market was, of course, much bigger than you would have expected a carnival, even one of this size, to encompass. Some of the vendors he recognized. Some watched warily as he and Sister Amelia passed. One or two, with looks of resignation, began to pack up their wares. The rules by which shadow markets existed were more the rules of long custom than those written down and codified. But everything about this shadow market felt wrong to Jem, and the silent brothers in his head were all debating how it might have come to be. Even if a shadow market had been right and proper in this place, there should not have been mundanes browsing and exclaiming over the strange goods on offer. Here went a man, looking pale and dreamy-eyed, blood still trickling from two neat punctures in his neck.
"I've never actually been to a shadow market," Sister Amelia said, slowing down. "My mother always said it was no place for shadow hunters and insisted that my brothers and I stay away from it." She seemed particularly interested in a booth that sold knives and weapons.
"Souvenirs later," Jem said, pushing on. "Business first."
They were suddenly out of the shadow market, and in front of a stage where a magician was telling jokes as he turned a small shaggy dog into a green melon, and then cut the melon in half with a playing card. Inside was a fiery sphere that rose up and hung in the air like a miniature sun. The magician, the sign above his head proclaimed him to be Roland the Astonishing, poured water out of his hat onto it, and the sphere became a mouse and ran off the stage into an audience that gasped and shrieked, and then applauded. Sister Amelia had stopped to watch, and Jem stopped too. She said, "Real magic?"
"Real illusions, at least," Jem said.
He gestured at the woman who stood at the side of the stage, watching the magician perform his tricks. The magician looked to be in his 60s, but his companion could have been any age at all. She was clearly of high fey lineage, and there was a baby in her arms. The way that she watched the magician on the stage made Jem's chest grow tight. He had seen Tessa look at Will the same way, with that rapt attention and love mingled with the knowledge of future sorrow that must, one day, be endured. Brother Enoch said again, "When the day comes, we will bear it with you." A thought came to Jem like an arrow, that when that day came and Will left the world, he did not wish to share his grief with his brothers, that others would be there with him when Will was not. And, too, there was Tessa. Who would stay to help her endure when Jem took the body that Will had left behind back to the Silent City? The fairy woman looked out over the crowd, and then drew back suddenly behind a velvet curtain. When Jem tried to see what she had seen, he saw a goblin perched on a flag above the top of a nearby tent. It appeared to be sniffing the wind, as if it smelled something particularly delicious. Mostly what Jem smelled now was demon. Sister Amelia craned her neck to see where Jem was looking and said,
"Another fairy! It's nice to be out in the world again. I'll have such a lot to write about in my diary when I'm back in the Iron Citadel."
"Do the Iron Sisters keep diaries?" Jem asked politely.
"That was a joke," Sister Amelia said. She actually looked disappointed in him. "Do Silent Brothers have any kind of sense of humor, or do they stitch that up too?"
"We collect knock-knock jokes," Jem said.
She perked up.
"Really? Do you have any favorites?"
"No," Jem said. "That was a joke."
And if he could have, he would have smiled. Sister Amelia was so very human that he found it was waking up some of the humanity he'd put aside so long ago. That, too, must have been why he was thinking of Will and Tessa and the person he'd been before. His heart would ache slightly less, he was sure, once they'd completed their mission, and Sister Amelia and he had been dispatched back to the places where they belonged. She had some of the same spark that Will had had back when he and Jem had chosen to be Parabatai. Jem had been drawn to that fire in Will, and he thought that he and Sister Amelia could have been friends too, under other circumstances. He was thinking this when a small boy tugged at his sleeve.
"Are you part of the carnival?"
the boy said.
"Is that why you're dressed like that? Is that why your face looks like that?"
Jem looked down at the boy, and then at the runes on his arms to make sure that they hadn't somehow been rubbed off. "You can see us?" Sister Amelia said to the boy.
"Course I can,"
the boy said.
"Nothing wrong with my eyes. Although, I think there must have been something wrong with them before, because now I see all sorts of things I never used to see."
"How?" Jem said, bending to peer into the boy's eyes. "What's your name? When did you start seeing things that you never used to see?"
"My name's Bill," the boy said. "I'm 8. Why are your eyes closed like that? How can you talk when your mouth isn't open?"
"He's a man of special talents," said Sister Amelia. "He should taste his chicken pot pie."
"Where are your people, Bill?"
the boy said.
"I live down in St. Elmo's, and I came up here on the Incline Railroad with my mother, and today I ate a whole bag of saltwater taffy, and I didn't have to share a piece with anyone else."
"Maybe the taffy had magical properties," Sister Amelia said softly to Jem.
"My mother said not to wander off," the boy said, "but I never pay attention to her unless she's head up like a kettle. I went through the maze of mirrors all by myself, and I got all the way to the middle where the fancy lady is, and she said as a prize, I could ask her for anything I wanted."
"What did you ask her for?" Jem said.
"I thought about asking for a battle with real knights and real horses and real swords, like in King Arthur, but the lady said if what I wanted was real adventures, I should ask to see the world as it really was. So I did. And after that, she put a mask on me, and now everything's strange, and also she wasn't a lady at all. She was something I didn't want to be around anymore, and so I ran away. I've seen all kinds of strange people, but I haven't seen my mother. Have you seen her? She's little, but she's ferocious. She has red hair like me, and she's got an awful temper when she's worried."
"I know all about that kind of mother," Sister Amelia said.
"She must be looking everywhere for you,"
Bill said.
"I am a constant trial to her, or so she says."
"Over there," Jem said. "Is that her?"
A small woman standing by a tent advertising, "Mysteries of the Worm, demonstrated thrice daily," was looking over in their direction.
"Bill Doyle," she said, advancing. "You are in a heap of trouble, my little man."
She had a carrying voice.
"I see my fate is upon me," Bill said in grave tones.
"You should flee before you become a casualty of battle."
"Don't worry for us, Bill," Sister Amelia said. "Your mother can't see us.
And I wouldn't mention us to her either. She'll think you're making it all up."
"It appears I've got myself into a real predicament," Bill said. "Fortunately, I'm as good at getting out of tight spots as I am getting into them. I have had lots of practice. A pleasure to have met both of you."
Then Mrs. Doyle was upon him. She seized her son's arm and began to pull him back toward the exit of the carnival, scolding him as they went. Jem and Sister Amelia turned to watch them go in silence. "Finally," Sister Amelia said, "the maze of mirrors, then."
And even if they hadn't encountered young Bill Doyle, they would have known they'd found the place they were looking for when they came to the maze of mirrors at last. It was a pointy structure, painted all over in glossy forbidden black, fissures of red running through the black paint, the red paint looking so fresh and wet that the building appeared to be seeping blood. Through the entrance, mirrors and lights dazzled. "The true world and the false," the sign said. "You shall know, even as you are known. Those who seek me will find themselves." The reek of demon malignance here was so strong that even Jem and Sister Amelia, wearing runes to keep from being overpowered by the stench, flinched. "Be careful," the voices in Jem's head warned. "This is no ordinary Eidolon demon." Sister Amelia had drawn her sword. Jem said, "We should be careful. There may be dangers here that we are not prepared for." Sister Amelia said, "I think we can be at least as brave as little Bill Doyle was, facing danger." "He didn't know he was dealing with a demon," Jem said.
"I meant his mother," Sister Amelia said. "Come on."
And so, Jem followed her into the maze of mirrors. They found themselves in a long, glittering corridor with many companions. Here was another Sister Amelia and another Brother Zachariah, stretched out monstrously thin and wavy. Here they were again, squashed and hideous. There they were, their reflections' backs turned to them. In one mirror, they lay upon the shores of a shallow purple sea, dead and bloated, and yet looking utterly content to be so, as if they had died of some great happiness. In another, they began to age rapidly, and then to crumble away to bare bones, the bones to dust. Sister Amelia had never been fond of mirrors, but she had a craftswoman's interest in these. When a mirror is made, it must be coated in some reflective metal. Silver could be used, though vampires were not fond of this kind. The mirrors in the maze of mirrors, she thought, must have been treated with some kind of demonic metal. You could smell it. Every breath she took in here coated her mouth, her tongue, her throat, with a kind of greasy residue of despair and horror. She walked forward slowly, her sword held in front of her, and stumbled into a mirror where she had thought there was an open space.
"Careful," Brother Zachariah said.
"You don't come to the carnival to be careful," she said. This was bluster, and perhaps he knew it, but bluster is a kind of armor too, as much as taking care is. Sister Amelia had appreciation for both.
"If it's a maze, then how are we to know which way to go?" she said.
"I could shatter the mirrors with my sword. If I broke them all, we would find the center."
"Hold your sword," Brother Zechariah said. He had paused in front of a mirror in which Sister Amelia was not present. Instead, there was a slender, white-haired boy holding the hand of a tall girl with a solemn, beautiful face. They were on a city avenue.
"That's New York," Sister Amelia said. "I thought you hadn't been there."
Brother Zechariah advanced to the mirror, which allowed passage as if it had never been there at all. The image was gone, like a popped soap bubble. "Go toward the reflections that show you whatever thing you most long to see," Brother Zechariah said, "but that you know to be impossible."
"Oh," Sister Amelia said, involuntarily. "Over there."
Over there was a mirror where a sister much like her, but with silvery hair, held a glowing blade between tongs. She plunged it into a bath of cold water, and steam shot up in the shape of a dragon, writhing and splendid. All her brothers were there too, watching in admiration. They passed through that mirror too. They made their way through mirror after mirror, and Sister Amelia felt her chest grow tight with longing. Her cheeks burned red too, that Brother Zechariah could see the vainest and most frivolous longings of her heart. But she saw the things that he longed for too. A man and a woman she thought must have been his parents, listening to their son play his violin in a great concert hall. A black-haired man with blue eyes and laugh lines around his mouth, building up a fire in a drawing room, while the solemn girl, smiling now, perched on the lap of Brother Zechariah. No longer a brother, but a husband, and a pair beside the company of the ones he loved most. They came to a mirror where the black-haired man, now old and frail, lay in bed. The girl sat curled up beside him, stroking his forehead. Suddenly Brother Zechariah came into the room, but when he threw back his hood, he had open, clear eyes and a smiling mouth. At this sight, the old man in the bed sat up and grew younger and younger, as if joy had renewed his youth. He sprang out of bed and embraced his parabatai.
"It is horrible," Sister Amelia said. "We should not see inside each other's hearts like this."
They passed through that mirror and now came face to face with one that showed Sister Amelia's mother, sitting before a window, holding a letter from her daughter. There was the most desolate look in her eyes, but then the mother in the reflection began, slowly, to compose a fire message to her daughter. "I am so very proud of you, my darling. I am so happy you have found your life's work."
"I see nothing shameful in you," Brother Zechariah said in his tranquil voice.
He held out his hand, and after a moment Sister Amelia looked away from the reflection of her mother, writing all the things she had never said. She took the offered hand gratefully.
"It is shameful to be vulnerable," she admitted, "or so I've always thought."
They passed through the mirror, and someone said,
"And that is exactly what a weapon maker and armorer would think. Don't you agree?"
They had found their way to the heart of the maze, and a demon was there with them. A handsome man, in a well-cut suit that was the worst thing that Sister Amelia had ever seen.
"Belial," Brother Zechariah said.
"Old friend," Belial said.
"I was so hoping it would be you they sent sniffing after me."
This was Sister Amelia's first time encountering a greater demon. She held the sword she had forged herself in one hand,
and Brother Zachariah's warm hand in the other. If it had not been for those two things, she knew she would have turned and fled. "Is that human skin?" she asked, her voice wavering. Whatever the suit was made of, it had the glazed, slightly cracked appearance of poorly tanned leather. It had a pink, blistered look to it. And yes, she could now see that what she had thought was an odd flower poking out of the boutonniere was actually a mouth pursed in agony, a cartilaginous lump of nose sagging over it. Belial looked down at the stained cuff sticking out past the sleeve. He flicked a speck off. "You have an eye, my dear," he said. "Whose skin is it?" Sister Amelia said. Her voice was steadier now, she found to her great relief. It was not so much that she wanted to know the answers, as that she had found quite early on in her training in the Iron Citadel that asking questions was a way to discipline your fear. Taking in new information meant you had something to focus on besides how terrifying your teachers or your environment was. "A tailor I employed," Belial said. "He was a very bad tailor, you see. But, in the end, he has made a very good suit after all." He gave her and Brother Zachariah the most charming smile, but in the mirrors all around them, his reflections gnashed their teeth and raged. Brother Zachariah gave every appearance of calm, but Sister Amelia could feel how tight his grip had grown. She said, "You're friends with him?" "We have met before," Brother Zachariah said. "Silent brothers do not choose the company they keep, though I will confess I find yours more to my taste than his."
"Hurtful," said Belial, leering. "And I fear honest. And I only enjoy one of those things."
"What is your business here?" Brother Zachariah said.
"No business at all," Belial said. "This is purely fun. You see, they turned up some adamas in the caverns underneath Ruby Falls, a small vein of it in the limestone. Do you know that people come from all over the country to gawk at Ruby Falls? A subterranean waterfall. I haven't seen it myself, but I hear it's spectacular. I did play a few rounds of Tom Thumb golf, though, and then I gorged myself sick on some of the famous saltwater taffy. Had to eat the taffy cellar afterwards to get the taste out of my mouth. I think there's still a little stuck in my teeth. Chattanooga, Tennessee. The slogan should be, come for the Adamus, stay for the saltwater taffy. They could paint it on barns.
Did you know there's a whole city underneath the city of Chattanooga? They had such terrible floods over the last century that finally they built over the original buildings. The old buildings are still there, underground, hollowed out like rotten teeth. And sure, everything is on higher ground now, but the floods still come. It washes away all the limestone, and what happens eventually? The foundations will crumble, and everything will be washed away in a deluge. There's a metaphor there, somewhere, little shadow hunters. You build, and you struggle, and you fight, but the darkness in the abyss will come one day in a great tide and sweep away everything that you love.
We didn't have time to tour Chattanooga, Brother Zachariah said. We're here for the Adamus. The Adamus! Of course, Belial said. You people kept such a tight grasp on the stuff.
You have it? Sister Amelia said.
I thought it was death to demons just the touch. Your ordinary sort will just explode, yes, Belial said. But I am a prince of hell, made of sterner stuff.
Greater demons can handle Adamus, Brother Zachariah said. Though my understanding is that it is agonizing to them.
Tomato of agony, tomato of agony, Belial said. His reflections in the various mirrors wet tears of blood. Do you know what causes us pain? The one who made us has turned his face from us. We are not allowed before the throne. But Adamus, that's angelic stuff. When we touch it, the pain of our absence from the divine is indescribable. And yet, it's the closest we ever get to being in its presence. So we touch the Adamus, and we feel the absence of our Creator. And in that absence, we feel the smallest spark
of what we once were. Oh, it's the most wonderful thing you can imagine. That pain. Brother Zechariah said, And God said, I shall not retain Belial within my heart. A sly, wounded look came over Belial's face. Of course you too, my dear brother Zechariah, have been cut off from the ones you love. We understand each other. And then he said something in a language that Sister Amelia did not recognize, almost spitting out the awful, hissing syllables. What is he saying? She said. She thought that the room seemed to be growing hotter. The mirrors were blazing brighter. He's speaking abyssal, Brother Zechariah said calmly. Nothing of any interest. He's doing something, Sister Amelia hissed. We have to stop him. Something is happening. In all the mirrors, Belial was swelling up, the suit of his skin bursting like the skin of a sausage. The mirror versions of Sister Amelia and Brother Zechariah were dwindling, shrinking, and blackening as if scorched by the heat of Belial.
Knock, knock, Brother Zechariah said.
What?
Sister Amelia said.
He said again.
Don't pay any attention to Belial. He thrives on it. It's not real. It's illusions, nothing more. Demons won't kill those they owe debt to. Knock, knock.
Who's there? She said.
Spell.
Sister Amelia's throat was so dry she could barely speak at all. The pommel of her sword was blazingly hot as if she had her hand in the heart of a forge.
Spell who?
If you insist. Brother Zechariah said. W-H-O.
And when Sister Amelia understood the joke, it was so very ridiculous that she laughed in spite of herself.
That's terrible, she said.
Brother Zechariah looked at her with his expressionless, sealed-off face. He said,
You didn't ask me if Silent Brothers had a good sense of humor.
Belial had stopped speaking abyssal. He looked incredibly disappointed in them both. This is no fun, he said.
What did you do with the Adamus?
Brother Zechariah said. Belial reached down into the neck of his shirt and drew up a chain. Dangling on the end of it was an Adamus half-mask. Sister Amelia could see his skin go red, and then grow raw and festering and yellow with pus where the mask touched him. And where he touched the mask, the metal flared up in coruscating ripples of turquoise, scarlet, viridian. But Belial's expression of proud indifference never changed. I've been using it on behalf of your precious mundane folk, he said. It strengthens my power as I strengthen its. Some of them want to be people other than themselves, and so I give them the illusion of that. Strong enough that they can fool others. Other people want to see something that they want, or that they've lost, or that they can't have, and I can do that too. There was a young man the other day, a boy, really. He was to be married, but he was afraid. He wanted to know the worst things that might happen to him and the girl he loved so that he could prepare for them and go on bravely. I hear he wasn't that brave after all.
He put out his eyes, Sister Amelia said. And what about Billy Doyle?
That one, I think, will have a remarkable life. Belial said. Or else end up in a lunatic asylum. Care to wager which? There shouldn't be a shadow market here, Brother Zechariah said.
There are many things that shouldn't be that are, Belial said. And many things that aren't that might still be if you only want them enough. I'll admit, I hope that the shadow market would provide better cover. Or at least, a warning to me when your kind showed up to spoil my fun. But you weren't distracted at all.
Sister Amelia will take the Adamus, Brother Zechariah said. And once you've given it to her, you will send the market away because I ask it of you.
If I do so, will that cancel out the favor that I owe you? Belial said.
He owes you a favor?
Sister Amelia said. She thought, no wonder they stitch up the Silent Brothers' mouths.
They have so many secrets.
It will not. Brother Zechariah said to Belial. To Amelia, he said,
Yes, and that is why you need not be afraid of him. A demon cannot kill one it is indebted to.
I could kill her, though, Belial said.
He took a step toward Sister Amelia, and she raised her sword, determined to make her death count.
But you won't,
Brother Zachariah said calmly. Belial raised an eyebrow.
I won't.
Why not? Brother Zachariah said,
Because you find her interesting. I certainly find her so.
Belial went silent. Then he nodded. Here. He threw the mask at Sister Amelia, who let go of Brother Zachariah's hand to catch it. It was lighter than she would have expected. I imagine they won't let you work it, though. Too worried I might have corrupted it in some way. And who's to say that I didn't? We're done, Brother Zachariah said. Go from here and do not return.
Absolutely, Belial said. Only about that favor. It pains me so to be in debt to you when I might be of some service. I wonder if there isn't a thing I could offer you. For example, the Yin Fen in your blood. Do the Silent Brother still not know what the cure might be?
Brother Zachariah said nothing. But Sister Amelia could see how his knuckles grew white where his fist clenched. At last he said,
Go on.
I might know a cure, Belial said.
Yes, I think I know a sure cure. You could be who you once were. You could be Jem again.
Or, Brother Zachariah said,
Or?
Belial's long tongue flicked out, as if he was tasting the air and found it delicious. Or I could tell you a thing you don't know. There are hair and nails, not the ones you know, but of the same bloodline as your Parabatai. They are in great danger. Their lives hang by a thread, and they are closer to us as we stand here than you can imagine. I can tell you something of them and set you on the path to find them if that is what you choose, but you must choose. To aid them, or else to be who you once were. To once more be the one who left behind those who loved him best, the one they still yearn for. You could be him again, if that is what you choose. Choose, Brother Zachariah. Brother Zachariah hesitated for a long moment. In the mirrors around them, Amelia saw visions of what Belial was promising, of all that his cure would mean. The woman Brother Zachariah adored would not be alone. He would be with her, able to share her pain and to love her wholly once more. He could rush to the side of the friend he loved, see his friend's blue eyes shine like the stars on a midsummer night as he beheld Brother Zachariah transformed. They could clasp hands with no shadow of grief or pain upon them just once. They had been waiting all their lives for that moment, and feared it would never come. In 100 reflections, Brother Zachariah's eyes flew open, blind and silver with agony. His face twisted as if he were being forced to endure the most terrible pain, or worse, forced to turn from the most perfect bliss. The real Brother Zachariah's eyes stayed closed. His face remained serene. At last, he said,
The Costers owe a life debt to the Herondales. That is my choice.
Belial said, Then here's what I will tell you about these lost Herondales. There's power in their blood, and there is great danger, too. They are in hiding from an enemy who is neither mortal nor demon. These pursuers are resourceful, and they're close on their heels, and they will kill them if they find them.
But where are they? Sister Amelia said.
Belial said, The debt is not that great, my dear, and now it's paid. Sister Amelia looked at Brother Zachariah, who shook his head.
Belial is what he is, he said, a fornicator, a miser, and a polluter of sanctuaries, a creator of illusions. If I had made the other choice, do you really think I would be better off?
How well we know each other, Belial said. We all play a role, and it would astonish you, I think, to know how helpful I am being. You think I have only offered you tricks and slights. But truly, I have extended the hand of friendship. Or do you think that I can simply draw these hair and nails out of a hat like so many rabbits? As for you, Sister Amelia, I owe you no debt, but would do you a good turn. Unlike our acquaintance here,
You have chosen the path that you are set on.
I have, Sister Amelia said. All she had ever wanted was to make things. To shape seraph blades and be known as a master of the forge. Shadow hunters, it seemed to her, gloried in destruction. What she longed for was to be permitted to create.
I can make it so that you were the greatest Adamus worker that Iron Citadel has ever seen. Your name would be spoken for generations.
In the mirrors, Sister Amelia saw the blades that she could make. She saw how they were used in battle, how the ones who wielded them thanked the one who made them. They blessed the name of Sister Amelia, and acolytes came to study with her, and they too blessed her name.
No, Sister Amelia said to her reflections. I will be the greatest Adamus worker that the Iron Citadel has ever seen, but it will not be because I accepted aid from you. It will be because of the work that I do with the aid of my sisters.
Nuts, Belial said. I don't even know why I'd bother.
Brother Zacharias said, Roland the Astonishing. And before Sister Amelia could ask him what he meant by that, he was running out of the maze. She could hear him knocking over mirror after mirror with his staff, in too much of a hurry to find his way out as they had found their way in. Or maybe he knew that all the magic was bound up to make the center hard to find, and that smashing things on the way out would work just fine.
A little slow on the draw, that one, Belial said to Sister Amelia. Anyhow, I ought to make tracks. See you around, girlie.
Wait, Sister Amelia said. I have an offer to make you. Because she could not stop thinking of what she had seen in Brother Zachariah's mirrors. How much he longed to be with his Parabatai and with the girl who must have been the warlock Tessa Gray.
Go on, Belial said. I'm listening.
I know that the things you offer us aren't real, Sister Amelia said. But perhaps the illusion of a thing that we can't have is better than nothing at all. I want you to give Brother Zachariah a vision, a few hours of the one he misses most.
He loves the warlock girl, Belial said. I could give her to him.
No, Sister Amelia said. Warlocks endure. I believe, one day, he will have his hours with Tessa Gray, even if he does not dare to hope for it. But his Parabatai, Will Herondale, is old and frail and drawing near the end of his life. I want you to give them both a span of time. Both of them, in a time and place where they could be young and happy. And together.
And what will you give me in return? Belial said.
If I had agreed to your previous offer, Sister Amelia said, I think that my name would have lived on in infamy. And even if I was one day celebrated for my work, still every blade that I made would have been tainted by the idea that you had had some part in my successes. Every victory would have been poisoned.
You're not as stupid as most shadow hunters, Belial said.
Oh, stop trying to flatter me, Sister Amelia said. You're wearing a suit made of human skin. No one of any sense should care what you have to say, but you should care very much about what I say to you. And that is this. I promise you, if you do not give Brother Zachariah and Will Herondale the thing that I'm asking for them, my life's work will be to forge a blade that is capable of killing you. And I will go on making blades until one day I accomplish my goal. And I warn you, I am not only talented, I am single-minded. Feel free to ask my mother if you don't believe me.
Belial met her gaze. He blinked twice and looked away. Sister Amelia could see, now, the way that he saw her reflected in the remaining mirrors, and she quite liked, for once, how she looked. You are interesting, he said, as Brother Zachariah said, but perhaps you are also dangerous. You're too small to make a suit. But a hat. You would make a fine Trilby. And perhaps a pair of spats. Why shouldn't I kill you now?
Sister Amelia stuck her chin out. She said, Because you are bored. You are curious whether or not I will be good at my work. And if my swords fail those who wield them, you will find it good entertainment.
Belial said, True, I will.
Amelia said, Then our deal?
Done, Belial said, and was gone, leaving Sister Amelia in a room walled in mirrors, holding an Adamus mask in one hand, and in her other a sword that was quite remarkable,
and yet in no way the equal of the blades that she would make one day. When she emerged onto the carnival thoroughfare, already many of the tents were gone or else simply abandoned. There were few people about, and those she saw looked dazed and dreamy as if they had just woken up. The bazaar of the bazaar was gone entirely, and there was not a single werewolf to be seen, although the cotton candy machine was still spinning slowly, filaments of sugar floating in the air. Brother Zechariah was standing in front of the empty stage where they had seen the magician and his fairy wife. "You all play a role, and it would astonish you, I think, to know how helpful I am being," he said. She realized that he was quoting Belial. "I have no idea what that means," she said. He waved his hand at the sign above the stage. "Roland the Astonishing." "Roland," she said slowly, "it would astonish you." "Tricks and sleights. He offered me the hand of friendship, sleight of hand, magic tricks. I should have known sooner. I thought the magician had the look of my friend Will, but he and his wife have fled." "You'll find them again," Sister Amelia said. "I feel quite sure." "They are Herondales, and they are in trouble," said Brother Zechariah. "So I will find them, because I must." And Belial did say something that has proved of some interest to my brothers. "Go on," Sister Amelia said. "I am as I am," Brother Zechariah said. "A silent brother, but not entirely of the brotherhood. Because for so long I was unwillingly dependent on Yin Fen. And now I am, not entirely wholeheartedly, a silent brother, so that I might remain alive in spite of the Yin Fen in my blood that should have killed me years ago. Brother Enoch and the others have long searched for a cure and found nothing. We had begun to think, perhaps, there was no cure. But Brother Enoch was extremely interested in the choice Belial offered me. He said he's already researching demonic cures associated with Belial."
"Then if you were cured," Sister Amelia said, "you would choose not to be what you are?"
Brother Zechariah said,
"Without hesitation. Though not without gratitude for what my brothers in the Silent City have done for me."
"And you, will you regret choosing a life in the Iron Citadel?"
Sister Amelia said,
"How can I know that? But no, I am being given an opportunity to become what I've always known I was meant to be. Come on, we've done what we were sent to do."
"Not quite," Brother Zechariah said. "Tonight is a full moon, and we don't know whether or not the werewolves have gone back into the mountains. As long as there are mundanes here, we must wait and watch. The Silent Brothers have sent messages to the Praetor Lupus. They take a hardline prohibitionist stance, not to mention they crack down hard on eating mundanes."
"Seems a little harsh," Sister Amelia said.
"The prohibitionist stance, I get that eating people is wrong, generally."
"Werewolves live by a harsh code," Brother Zechariah said. She could not tell, by looking at his face, whether or not he was joking, but she was fairly sure that he was. He said, "Though now that you've passed your test, I know you must be anxious to return to the Iron Citadel. I'm sorry to keep you here." He wasn't wrong. She longed with all of her heart to go to the only place that had ever truly felt like home to her. And she knew, too, that some part of Brother Zechariah must dread returning to that silent city. She had seen enough in the mirrors to know where his home and his heart was. She said, "I'm not sorry to tarry here a little longer with you, Brother Zechariah, and I'm not sorry that I met you. If we never meet again, I will hope that one day, a weapon made by my hand may yet prove useful to you in some way." Then she yawned. Iron sisters, unlike silent brothers, required things like sleep and food. Brother Zechariah hoisted himself up onto the edge of the stage and then patted the space beside him. "I'll keep watch. If you grow weary, sleep. No harm will come while I keep vigil."
Sister Amelia said,
"Brother Zechariah, if something strange happens tonight, if you should see something that you thought you would not see again, don't be alarmed. No harm will come of it."
"What do you mean?" Brother Zechariah said. "What did you and Belial discuss when I had gone?"
In the back of his mind, his brothers murmured,
"Be careful. Be careful. Be careful. Oh, be careful."
Sister Amelia said,
Nothing of any great importance. But I think he's a little afraid of me now. And he should be. He offered me some